I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Today on the show, we're joining the urban revolution with our guest, Jeb Brugman. Jeb is an author and urban development consultant whose latest book, The Urban Revolution, How Cities Are Changing the World, makes the case that the city is now a medium for revolutionary change. We'll also speak with Charles Payne. Charles's latest book, So Much Reform, So Little Change, examines why almost 30 years of school reform have brought so little change to urban public schools. We'll find out why, despite the best intentions of teachers, administrators, lawmakers, and parents, the urban public school system still struggles to right itself. We'll also hear from our regular contributor, Walker Smith, and the latest news from Nate Berg. Stick around for Smart City coming up after this news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. My first guest on the show is leading a revolution. Author and urban development consultant Jeb Brugman has worn many hats in his career. He's a founding partner of The Next Practice and the founder of the International Council for Local Environmental Initiatives. His latest book, due out in May, is called Welcome to the Urban Revolution. And in it, he describes the fundamental advantages to living in cities and how the solutions to problems facing cities today can solve problems worldwide. Jeb, what is the urban revolution?
Well, what I'm arguing in my book is that we've, in effect, missed a fundamental change in the way that we are organized as a species. And we've labeled it with all kinds of things. This fundamental change, we called it the Industrial Revolution. And then we call it globalization, which is an even more abstract term. But my argument is that there are fundamental advantages that people have gained over the centuries from locating themselves in cities. In effect, in cities, they can cluster together and develop markets and figure out how to build competitive advantage in those markets. And that these underlying economic advantages of urban settlement have driven an entire restructuring of global economics, of the way we organize ourselves as people, even the way we mate with one another, and of global ecology. We're now at a stage where so many people have moved to cities, and the momentum of economic and ecological change is so hinged on the growth of our cities that it's having a revolutionary change, and it's now at a global scale. And the concept of the city itself and what a city is has fundamentally changed from being something that was local and a jurisdiction and municipal to actually a global system that is at the same scale as the global climate system or the oceans. It's a giant, integrated, connected global system now that is driving the way our world works.
Explain what you mean by this concept of a global city system. You talk about it in your book, but I think that it seems almost contrary, right, to the idea of a city. So talk about that a little bit more.
What has happened is that people within their traditional regions, say an agricultural region that had a market town, have over time migrated to that market town. And in that market town created new markets and new ways of creating livelihoods and producing and organizing their society and their politics. And with those markets in these local places, they have figured out strategies for using the infrastructure that they can create because they have markets, roads and eventually telephones and airports, to create opportunities to extend what is successful in their city to other cities around the world. So you find all kinds of ethnic groups who have figured out, for instance, how to take over the retail sector, the small retail sector in the cities of their region. And they've taken that model, much as we see Koreans in the discount store market in U.S. cities today. They've taken that model that they developed in the cities of their own region, and they've now extended it. They've exported it to other cities around the world. And so you have to imagine that each city has been a magnet for all kinds of entrepreneurial people to come together and figure out how to secure a better livelihood and create advantage in a local market. And then they've extended what they've learned to other cities around the world. So what you end up with is uncounted networks of people who are each plying their own strategy within the cities of the world. And all of that connecting between the cities has created a massive interdependency between all our cities, so that the flows of people, the flows of money, the flows of materials now between cities actually make it operate like a system in its own right at a global scale. And I mentioned in the book, for instance, we think of globalization as something being driven by big companies and their investment flows around the world. But the remittances of global migrants who have moved from a city in their country to cities around the world, back to their home cities and families at home, those remittances are at times equivalent to right now about half of the foreign direct investment of global corporations. So this urbanization process, or what we've referred to as globalization, is much more than what governments and corporations are doing. It's kind of a grassroots process that involves billions of people who are using urban location to advance their family, their ethnic group, their political strategies, their market strategies around the world.
In your book, you write something that is so obviously true that it's quite easy to forget. You write, people and organizations don't go to cities for their problems. People and organizations build and flock to cities and will continue doing so because they are massive generators of opportunity, what you call the urban advantage. Describe it in brief.
Let's look at it as four unique dynamics of cities. The first one is density. So that when people cluster together and build in a dense form, what they do is create massive efficiencies relative to rural and other forms of settlement, for instance, semi-urban or suburban settlements. So density allows us to provide ourselves with energy, to move materials like water around much more efficiently because there's less energy and distance that needs to be covered. When people get together in high density, they create a market dynamic that allows stable markets to develop. So then the second dimension of cities is their scale. So when you get enough people clustering together to take advantage of what I call economies of density, what happens is you create economies of scale so that the fixed costs of doing anything are distributed over a much larger group of people. And I think for the most part, we're familiar with economies of scale. So when you get density and scale happening together, an interesting thing happens. It increases massively the efficiency at which people can connect with people who have similar interests and ambitions. And so you get a third economy in cities, which I call economies of association. People can actually find like-minded people and they can interact with one another much more efficiently than in rural settings. And in a way, this is why you see mating practices among people really differentiating between rural areas and cities. In rural areas, people use caste and social group in order to find their mates because that's how they efficiently are able to connect with people with similar ambitions. In cities, you find very different things. Social group, even personal interest among people, is less important in mating decisions now in cities. What's more important is people's economic prospects, as it turns out. And then the fourth one is that when you have people with similar interests and ambitions and who share a strategy for how to develop the city to achieve some common purpose, and you have economies of density and scale, what you're able to do finally is create very expensive infrastructure systems and spread those costs among a user group. So that's why it's only in cities that we first had telephone networks, that we first had road systems, that we had airports. It's those four economies that will continue to drive people to cities, that make cities the centers of opportunity in the world. And sadly, we come out of a tradition, of a rural pastoral tradition in terms of our culture that tells us that the cities are the places of crime and of pollution and of corruption. And so we sort of begrudgingly accept the cities in our lives rather than really understanding we were making a very logical choice to move from a place of lesser opportunity to a place of greater opportunity.
Your perspective on cities has been shaped by your extensive work globally. Tell me about that work.
It's a funny career path. I moved to the People's Republic of Cambridge, Massachusetts in my early 20s, and it was at a time when there was a lot of peace activism in Cambridge, and You may recall that at that time, towns like Cambridge and Berkeley and elsewhere were organizing into nuclear-free zones. And I was hired by the city to actually try to create a more moderate path between the peace movement in Cambridge that wanted to ban all nuclear weapons research and such in the city and the industry in Cambridge that was dependent on that. And so I was hired to develop a diversification strategy for those industries working as a city employee and use that opportunity to connect with mayors and city councilors all over the United States, eventually about 600 altogether, who did not think that the foreign policy that the U.S. was taking at the time represented the best interests of their cities or of the country. And so we created something called municipal foreign policy, you know, which in a way was anachronistic and perhaps even flaky in its own right, but it represented, I think, one of the first instances in which cities were developing an awareness that they are part of a global community. We lived in the Cold War, in which people thought in very nationalistic terms, and suddenly cities were connecting with one another across these Cold War barriers. So, for instance, Cambridge connected with a city in what was then Soviet Armenia, and we started helping refuseniks get out. We brought in laboratory equipment to environmental groups so that they could have independent monitoring of factories. So cities were connecting up with one another, and it dawned on me that this kind of work was so successful through the 80s that we ought to start turning this kind of intercity cooperation into a new mechanism to help the international community implement global environmental conventions. And at the time, the United Nations was negotiating the Montreal Protocol to ban chemicals that destroy the stratospheric ozone layer. And I met with the now Nobel Prize-winning scientist Sherwood Rowland and the mayor of his city, Larry Agron, and we said, let's see if we can't get cities around the world to start passing local laws to phase out these chemicals because our countries aren't moving fast enough. And that resulted in a relationship with the United Nations Environment Program, which led to my establishing a worldwide agency that now has more than 800 cities around the world in its membership and involved with it, that works with the UN and other international institutions to promote sustainable development and implement agreements like the Kyoto Protocol. So that gave me an occasion to work around the world with cities in all kinds of stages of development to think about how they could plan and manage their growth and their development in a way that would be more sustainable and equitable.
In what you call the most recent phase of the urban revolution, 1950 to 2000, cities grew largely beyond our control, inefficiently and problematically. A central premise in your book is that this mismanaged growth seeded many of the problems we wrestle with today, from climate change and transnational crime to terrorism and epidemic disease. Explain the connection for me between badly managed growth and, say, terrorism.
What we see in cities around the world is that as poor populations have migrated from rural areas, existing residents and elites have marginalized them and have not developed a pathway for them to be integrated into the legal or what is called the formal economy. And so in countries all over the world, we've not only found slums cropping up, but what I call parallel cities. In other words, urban migrants excluded from the existing city not only create their own settlements, but they create their own economies within those settlements. They develop ways of building and using the city that gives them a kind of competitive advantage in their local regional economies. They create their own legal systems. They create their own politics and governance. And you end up having cities organizing within cities and competing with each other. A lot of transnational crime actually rises out of what we understand as slums, but what in effect are highly sophisticated cities that are managed, planned, governed, financed by these informal, excluded populations. And criminal enterprise becomes an important aspect of their development in that it creates the finance for them to build their businesses. So in Los Angeles, for instance, gangs that first started just in the business of controlling those local territories actually developed a whole criminal economy. And they call them in India, I think what they should be called, criminal companies that lived within these parallel cities, and then they started exporting their business models around the world. So from Pico Union, a little district in Los Angeles, where illegal immigrants from the war in El Salvador were excluded and forced to find a way to make their economic ends meet in Los Angeles, they developed, in effect, a criminal business model, which has now been exported to cities throughout the Western Hemisphere. And the MS-13 is now one of the most brutal, fastest-growing criminal organizations in the world. It's monitored by the U.S. Southern Command. And all of that came out of a little slum area of about 10 to 15,000 people in Los Angeles.
You contend that the scale of our problems and the continued growth of the city, which is inevitable, demand a new strategy to manage growth. What does that strategy look like?
Yeah, well, I think the subprime mortgage crisis, in a way, guides us to that answer. We've put attention rightfully on the deregulation of the banking industry and how mortgage products were turned into derivative products that were then traded in the financial markets. But the first step of the subprime crisis hasn't been talked about much, which is that what we've done is move from building cities as communities who have a common strategy for creating some location-based competitive advantage in the world. What we've done is we've moved from understanding how to do urbanism together to mass-scale industrial city building, which is what you see around most of the periphery of most North American cities. I call them city models. In other words, builders have figured out how to value and engineer a certain product and certain business processes so that they can replicate these things at scale. And it's called a suburban subdivision. It's called a shopping mall. It's called a strip mall. These are standardized industry products that now get cookie cutter built all over the world. So you can see in Kuala Lumpur and in southern China and in Las Vegas, new city that looks very much the same because, in effect, it is very much as part of a global industry. So we moved to doing that, which now has nothing to do about organized communities of people figuring out how to create advantage together. It's about scaling up a product and giving people sort of a basic value, some place to live, some place to work. Doesn't necessarily create the efficiencies of density and scale and association that we need to be competitive in the world. With a subprime, we went to the next level. We went beyond industrial city building to actually commodified city building. So a lot of what happened and was at the root of the subprime crisis was people building and buying and selling new parts of cities for speculative purposes, right? So a lot of the condo buildings in Miami that sit empty, they were purchased, those units were purchased by people who never intended to even use them. Right, they didn't even move into them. They bought them to flip them and have them reflipped and have them reflipped. And so the subprime is about commodifying the city and stripping it of the economic value that we can have if we organize and develop our cities in very smart ways. Now, the opposite of that is what I see going on in Silicon Valley today. Right. So what happened in Silicon Valley is a group of industrialists and academicians figured out if we build a place for industry that works well with a university campus, it works well with the residential area and a commercial area, and that's all efficient. We create a community here in which we can very efficiently associate with one another, innovate together, and serve our basic needs. Then we can create competitive advantage in this district. And as Silicon Valley grew, it got into industrial city expansion, you know, with suburban sprawl and office parks. And what's happening there now is the business community and the residents and the municipalities are coming back together and saying, actually, we need to go back to our roots of what was the urbanism that gave us competitive advantage to begin with. And you see them now creating more mixed use, rebuilding the downtowns, organizing together to create a new boulevard through the district that ties it together. And so the parts of the world that are really thinking about locational advantage and competitive advantage are going back to understanding how does urbanism work and moving away from this industrial and commodified type of city building, which dominates the growth of urban areas in the world today.
Yeah, let's talk about how urbanism works, because, again, in your book, Jeb, you argue for relying on what you call an urban genetic code with an organic force that allows a city system to evolve rather than, say, what you've just termed city models or commodified city building or a world-class master plan, monumental ad hoc kind of city building. I want to understand how you find that code, decipher that code, and put that code to work, that urban genetic code you write about. As you call for moving toward urbanism, from building cityscapes where there's little attention given to total productivity and efficiency, how do you get from here to there? Even in your own city of Toronto, you say that progress has been slow.
Extremely slow, and I think in Toronto the example is that there's a movement in Toronto that's very much like the movement in Silicon Valley right now. People are saying, hold it. We know something about what made the city work. Let's stop looking around the world and get back to our roots and really get serious about why it is that an 11-foot sidewalk creates a different dynamism in this part of the city than a 6-foot sidewalk. And let's enforce that. You know, it's down to the details of how we design the minutiae of cities as much as it's about strategy in terms of competitiveness and land costs and taxing costs and things like that. But the fundamental change that needs to happen is that the planning community and local governments need to work with their local developer community and find ways to change their business process so that they start designing specialized solutions for communities of residents and users. We need to get back to using development to reinforce the creation of communities who have a common strategy for creating wealth and economic advantage in the city. And the process of city building has to support that. What's happened now is a whole process of coming up with a development plan, submitting it to city governments for their approval, does not include any user community at all. And what's odd about that is in industries across the board, there's been a massive shift in corporate strategy to what's called co-creating the products with the consumer base, right? So the consumer, Dell computer, the consumer is now involved in creating the machine that that consumer wants. And we have changed business process and invested heavily to make sure that communities of consumers can be engaged in helping to design their products. But when it comes to city building, we no longer build in a way that allows us to create tailored districts of cities to tailored groups of users and residents so that they can achieve a strategy together, they can invest in it together, they know how to maintain it, they know how to use it, and leverage economic advantage in the world together out of that.
Jeb, thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you, Carol. Thanks so much.
Jeb Brugman's latest book, Welcome to the Urban Revolution, How Cities Are Changing the World, will be out in May. For a link to the book, go to our website, smartcityradio.com. For the latest news in the world of urban planning and design, we turn to Nate Berg of Plan Edison.
The months leading up to last year's Summer Olympics in Beijing brought a tidal wave of development to the city, with iconic new architecture popping up all over town. It's estimated that nearly 500 million square feet of private commercial real estate was developed since 2006. But now that the Olympics are over, the construction boom is starting to look more like a bust. A recent article from the Los Angeles Times reports that almost one-fifth of that space, 100 million square feet, sits empty. Even if growth rates match up to historic highs, it will take more than a decade to fill the empty space. And even Olympic venues are feeling the bust. Underused sites are being eyed for demolition or dramatically different reuse. The Bird's Nest Stadium, for instance, has only one event scheduled for 2009. As China struggles with the hangover of this building boom, prospective Olympic host countries should be paying very close attention. Meanwhile, in the States, America's own bust is being felt in municipalities from coast to coast. Small cities and towns tend to take an especially hard hit when the economy dives, because they often rely on only a handful of industries and businesses. So when those businesses fail, an economic recession can be a death toll for entire communities. A recent article from the website Tom Dispatch looks at the vulnerability of small cities and the countless towns across the country on the verge of collapse. And as unemployment rises in these small cities, bigger cities may not be far behind. Many worry that the dying small towns of America may be canaries in the coal mine for some of the country's major metropolises. But despite the trouble facing many small cities, these places may also represent hope for the future. A recent article in the Boston Review by Catherine Tumber argues that small cities are going to be essential to creating a green and sustainable future. Small cities will be the sites of local agriculture and renewable energy industries, keeping our cities and nation as a whole running. But making sure small cities get there is going to be a challenge going forward. Traditional urban planning models don't give smaller cities and towns the credit they deserve in contributing to the health of metropolitan regions, Tumber argues. Until small towns and big cities can be thought of as an interdependent ecology, the smaller places will continue to struggle. For Plan Edison, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is the assistant editor of PlanEdison.com. Coming up in the second half of our show, Charles Payne from the University of Chicago will join us to talk about the disappointing results of most attempts to reform urban public schools and what we can do to see successful educational reform. I'm Carol Coletta. And a special welcome to our podcast listeners. You've heard us talk about our social networking site, My City, and the community there has been booming. Hundreds of listeners, just like you, have joined the site and are talking and collaborating on all the issues that mean the most to people who love cities. Want to join? Send us an email to our producer, Scotty, at smartcityradio.com, and he'll get you signed up. I look forward to seeing you online, and now back to the show. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. My next guest, Charles Payne, is the Frank Dixon Distinguished Service Professor at the University of Chicago. He's the author of numerous books, and his latest is a sobering look at the plight of urban public schools. The book, So Much Reform, So Little Change, looks at the failure of sweeping school reforms of the last 30 years and explains why they have swept so little. Charles, why does failure persist in urban schools?
It persists in urban schools in part because we continue to think about the problem in overly simplistic terms. We continue to look for magic bullets, to think that if we can solve the problem of merit pay for teachers or the problem of school governance or the problem of the quality of the workforce, if we can solve one of those, we'll solve the whole problem. All of those matter in one way or another. And they're all tied together with a bundle of other problems, including a whole series of social and political issues that we tend not to recognize at all. And we have to learn to appreciate more deeply the twistedness and the complexity of the problem.
How do you describe to the policymaker in the simplest terms possible, although I know that you're saying simplicity perhaps is the problem, but it's hard, and you know this, it's hard to get a policymaker's attention unless you can make it simple.
Absolutely.
So make it as simple for me as you can without making it simplistic.
Well, I think that one of the things that we've learned is that in order to make deep and lasting change in schools, you've got to be moving on multiple fronts simultaneously. So that if you're improving, say, the quality of the instructional leadership, the quality of the relationships among the adults, the degree, for example, to which they trust one another, and you're improving the school as an organization, if you're moving on three or four fronts simultaneously, it doesn't have to be those three. I don't think there's anything magic about those, right? Then you have a chance. Now, that may be too complicated for some audiences, right? So maybe the best metaphor that I have is that urban school systems are often like depressed individuals, right? They function well beneath their capacity. And even things that are relatively simple to do become difficult for them to do unless they get support. And the support has to be intensive and ongoing.
Now, early in your book, you paint a vivid picture of urban school culture, and you use that then to challenge the transferability of best practices. Explain why so-called best practices frequently don't transfer well.
Well, and it depends on how people are thinking about them. Sometimes when people use that best practice discourse, what they're saying is, I went to school so-and-so, and they were teaching reading in such-and-such a way. And that's the best practice. They were getting good results. So if we teach reading in such and such a way, we can get the same results. Well, ain't that simple, right? What that too often leaves out is the context in which school A was doing it, right? So school A may have a context in which you had a lot of instructional leadership. You had a principal who actually understood what the program was supposed to do, who could monitor it and support it. You may have had, and this is one of the big ones, teachers who had high expectations. Teachers who themselves understood the program intimately and who had been well trained. You take the program itself out of that context, that supportive context, and simply transfer the program to another context. Too often we wind up with nothing, or at the best we wind up with results that pale in comparison to what the program did in a supportive context.
What does it take to change a school culture? There's the school culture, and then there is also the district culture. And sometimes those can be two different things, but certainly district culture should support school culture and vice versa.
Yes, and I should be rich and handsome, too.
Well, yeah. What do you do to work on culture?
In a lot of ways, we know now, we know a lot about the centrality of leadership, right? That everything sort of starts there. I'm not sure that I can say that we know how in a reliable way to reproduce high-quality leadership, but we know that that's the engine. And I would say that we also know at this point in time that changing school culture requires both a carrot and a stick. We know that some of the most effective teachers in the inner city are teachers who are distinctively demanding and distinctively supportive of their students. I think that's probably a good broad description of some of the most successful leaders as well. They are demanding, right? I mean, they will break people's heads. They will hurt folk. They will literally have to fire folk. It's arguable that the most successful of the big city systems right now is Atlanta under Beverly Hall. And at a pretty close guess, she probably fired 90% of the principals that who were in the city when she took office. You have to have that toughness, right? But at the same time, it can't just be beating on people, right? You also have to make people understand that you can help them grow professionally and that when things get tough, you're going to be there. I think when we find that combination of leadership at the district level or at the school level, at least you have a chance to see cultural change.
Well, you raise an important point. When you talk about leadership as being central, the engine, do we have enough leaders in the pipeline to head both districts and schools?
Have you seen a pipeline?
Okay.
I mean, that's the question, right? I don't know very much about new leaders for new schools, but at least they have the idea that we have to be doing something systematic to produce leadership, and I just don't see enough of that going on around the country.
What about those people coming out of universities with their master's degrees and ready to be principals? Why aren't they prepared?
You know, that's almost a joke, right? It's hard. The universities know just about as much about this as they do about making rain in Peru next week. The universities have been shamefully disconnected from the realities of urban schools. And the notion that we can rely on them and them alone to train a cadre of leaders to do something the university faculty don't know how to do, by and large, right? No, it's going to take much more than that. And there are some things that I'm encouraged by. I mean, I came to Chicago because I really respect the way in which it's trying to become more deeply involved with its urban schools. One of the things that happens in our, you know, relatively small teacher training program is that our faculty stay in touch with our graduates for their first 2 years in the classroom. Boston, the Boston Teacher Residency, has a program like that, so that as you're training urban professionals, you don't, once they go into the field, the university faculty don't leave them. It should be the same with principals. I think Bank Street College in New York trains principals that way. Once they get their little sheet of paper, the faculty at Bank Street helps them think through the problems they encounter in their own schools. But by and large, the universities have, I think, been fundamentally irresponsible on this issue.
Well, if universities are irresponsible, and I don't disagree, then the question, I guess, is, are districts irresponsible? Are districts qualified, school districts qualified to raise up their own leadership?
Well, you know what? Bits and pieces of the answer are in lots of different places. I mean, there are people inside districts who can recognize good leadership and support it. That tends not to be the norm, but certainly there are people there. There are people inside universities. There are people inside the research community, all of whom have bits and pieces of the answers. The problem is bringing them together in some way that creates something coherent. And again, we're seeing far too little of that. At this point in time, one of the ironies is that district leadership is far more energetic, far more forceful, pushing much harder than was the case, I don't know, 20 or 30 years ago in this country. But too often, they're pushing people to do something they themselves don't know how to do, right? They did not grow up, they did not get the positions that they're in, by and large, because of their success at increasing the quality of instructions. And so that you often find district people themselves trying to get a lot done quickly, responding by putting a lot of top-down pressure that isn't balanced by support. I think that's just one of the problems that we're in at this historical moment that we didn't have 15 or 20 years ago.
You list in your book what you see as impediments to instructional capacity that exist at the school building level. And we were just talking about pressure coming from the top down to do things that maybe people at the top really don't know how to do. They didn't experience it themselves. But they're pushing harder for things to get done. So when you get down to that school building level, what are those impediments to instructional capacity? I know it's a long list, but could you summarize it?
In that long list, I guess the first thing I almost always think about is simply teacher expectations. And I actually don't blame teachers for this, right? People, they're people placed in a difficult position. They have a hard job to do, and they're systematically unresourced and typically don't have the leadership they need. In that capacity, teachers often develop a blaming culture. They blame the parents. They blame the children. Both urban parents and urban children represent issues, right? That doesn't mean that children can't learn when schools are sufficiently organized and address that issue in the right way. But the point is that the culture of most urban schools becomes a culture in which everybody expects the least of everyone else. Parents have low expectations of teachers. Teachers have low expectations of students and parents. And it becomes a self-reinforcing cycle.
How do you change that?
Somebody has to make a demand. Somebody has to take away the option of not teaching children, which is what we did in this country for, I'm not sure, maybe 30 years. Our city systems were largely laissez-faire. Teachers did pretty much what they wanted to do. When I first started studying schools in Chicago, it was nothing for a teacher to sit in the classroom all day and read the newspaper with a researcher sitting right in the classroom. It just wasn't a big deal. We moved away from that, and part of the reason we have moved away from that is the development of cultures of accountability. They have made some differences, but that's only a beginning. You have to combine accountability with support.
Interestingly, you say we know what works. You list the big six, the characteristics of high-impact instructional programs in urban districts, things like more instructional time, intellectually ambitious instruction, something you've been talking about, the existence of a professional community, program coherence, and teacher quality. Let me ask the same question I ask you about leadership. Do we have enough quality teachers who can deliver intellectually ambitious instruction?
At this point, my guess is no. But I'd frame the question differently. Do we have teachers who can be developed to the point where they can do that? If you put the question that way, then my guess is that, 80% of the teaching force we have right now can do a qualitatively better job with the right support, the right professional development, and the right level of accountability.
Do you think we can attract new people into teaching, given the school culture?
Yes, we can attract them, but can we retain them? I think a lot of people who follow urban schools in the last decade have been pleased, and I would say maybe a little surprised, at the degree to which once they have made some progress in straightening out their personnel procedures, their hiring procedures, a number of the large cities, Chicago, Memphis, New York City, are finding it possible to attract and hire a higher quality candidate, in terms of the measurables when I say higher quality, right? Test scores, the kind of schools that they come from. That's turning out to be possible. What we don't know yet is whether or not these systems can retain them unless they're given support. The Consortium on Chicago School Research surveys schools here every couple of years, and they have found that one question is a very, very strong predictor of whether or not new teachers will stay in the building. And that question is something like, does anyone in this building support you as a newcomer? Just knowing the answer to that tells you a lot about whether or not teachers are going to stay in the building. So yes, we can attract a higher quality, a higher caliber teacher, but we still have to work a lot on retaining them.
We've been through so many school reforms. Is there something you can say generally about what's working?
I wouldn't worry about the shape of the reform so much. I don't worry about the programs. What I worry about much more is the quality of the implementation, how carefully the program is put into place, how well it's monitored, how well it's resourced. We have this ongoing cycle of reform after reform after reform, each one shallowly implemented. And it's like we cannot get off the bicycle. I'd pay a lot more attention to how we put things in place. I wouldn't get so much involved in the ongoing warfare among us about my program over your program. I mean, that's one thing. Then the other thing, if you look at the cities which have made progress on the NAEP, National Assessment of Education Progress, there is a study of the cities which have made the most progress, in progress right now, by the Council of Great City Schools. But some of the things I would bet on: you're going to find deep, ongoing professional development. You're going to find a consistent attention to leadership evaluation and leadership development. You're going to find coherent curricula. You're going to find attempts to stabilize the teaching population, to keep folk in their schools. And in the very best of them, you're going to find relationship building. You're going to find school systems that are trying to make kids feel that there are some adults in their building who know about them and who care about them in a way that goes beyond their just being students. Those are at least some of the elements that we tend to see. But also, I want to stress, it's an attitude, it's a culture of not settling for mediocrity, right, that we see in the most successful urban districts.
We have a new administration. We have a new Secretary of Education, whom you know. What, in your opinion, is the proper role of the federal government in improving urban schools?
Well, anything they can do to equalize national funding for schools is a step in the right direction. The research conversation in the last 8 years has been deeply politicized. Only certain kinds of research got any attention during the Bush years. That certainly needs to be reversed. urban schools have improved by some measures. Test scores, you know, we all know there are problematics of test scores. In some cities, they have improved in terms of the dropout rate, not overwhelmingly dramatic, although that varies from place to place. Some places have made pretty impressive strides. My sense of where the urban systems are right now is that they're having a hard time grappling with the issue of instruction. And some of the discussion that we see about school governance, let's have more charters, let's have more schools of this kind or another kind, I think operates to actually detract us from the conversation we need to be having, which is a conversation about how do you put high-quality instruction in place for every child and how do you support the instructors to do that. It would be wonderful if the federal government could play a role in leading and shaping that discussion.
Don't you think, though, that charter schools and those sorts of innovations are the thing that are forcing the discussion on better instruction and better leadership?
Almost the opposite.
Oh, really?
What's happening is that charter schools, one, are turning out to be very difficult to implement well, right? And that means a couple of things. One of the things it means they're having a great many of them are having more difficulty than they anticipated reaching a high level of achievement as measured by test, and a great many of them have significant turnover of students or staff or both. And so that one of the arguments being developed in charter schools now and by charter school advocates that, if we're going to have teachers who are cycling through every 3 or 4 years,